It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a new collection of short stories set in Milwaukee explores the city's ups and downs. We'll talk to the editor of Milwaukee Noir about the authors he brought together for the project and the stories they told. First, under a new 440-page rule from the Trump administration, healthcare providers, workers, and insurers can refuse to perform or pay for certain services that they say violate their religious or moral beliefs. The president announced the change at the White House during the National Day of Prayer last week.
Every citizen has the absolute right to live according to the teachings of their faith and the convictions of their heart. This is the bedrock of American life. To protect this heritage, my administration has strongly defended religious liberty, two words you haven't heard too much about for a long period of time, but now you're hearing it all the time, religious liberty.
While conservatives praised the announcement, LGBT and women's groups criticized it, saying it essentially amounts to discrimination. So what would actually change under the White House rules? Amy Goldstein is a healthcare policy writer for The Washington Post and the author of Janesville, An American Story. Amy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Good to be with you again.
Well, we're at 400-plus pages. There's a lot going on here. Can you help us understand the scope of this new ruling from the White House?
Well, this is a very broad rule that was issued by the Department of Health and Human Services. And what it does is basically spell out certain kinds of health care services or health insurance coverage that under this rule, companies or doctors or other kinds of providers of care can say they're not comfortable providing based, as you said, on the religious or moral beliefs. And these are things such as abortion, assisted suicide in states where that's legal, sterilization services for people who want to not become pregnant. So this is a very broad rule that says that there's a whole bunch of things that people can say we don't want to do for patients or, in the case of insurance companies, for customers because we don't believe that they're right.
Now, the Catholic Association backed the idea. They said healthcare workers shouldn't have to choose between their practice or their faith. And they said that principle is enshrined in countless laws and regulations. They say that's been violated. So that's part of the argument here, is that a lot of this has to do with rules already on the books that at least the White House and people who support this rule say just aren't being enforced right now. Is that right?
Well, there's a big disagreement about whether this is a good or bad thing to do, a legal or an unconstitutional thing to do. And the proponents of it, who tend to be people who are kind of the conservative religious community, which is a group that was very much in support of Donald Trump's election as president in 2016, they think this is terrific. And they make the point, as you just said, that there are a number of laws that already have existed that this rule would be the companion to. On the other hand, groups such as the American Civil Liberties Union or a number of women's rights groups say that this is discriminatory and that it's improper for anyone to say, we're not going to provide medical services or medical coverage of kinds that are legal in this country.
Let's talk about more about some of those concerns. We've heard from LGBT groups. They're one of the groups that's worried about this. One of the items specified, as I understand it, has to do with transgender issues, things like gender reassignment surgery. What do the rules say about that?
Well, the whole idea of gender transition and the both medical and so kind of social support services associated with that are part of what this rule gives medical providers permission to decline to carry out. That's obviously, as you just suggested, of great concern to people in the gay community, people who are transgender and advocating for them. So that's a big cause of concern. There's also a section of this big rule that relates to parents' rights to refuse certain kinds of care on behalf of their children. So, for instance, the rule says that if a parent is not comfortable with a child getting who, you know, somebody thinks may have suicidal tendencies or suicidal thoughts, that the parent can step in and say, no, we don't want a suicide assessment done on my child, or we don't want early treatment done if somebody suspects that a child may be inclined towards suicide. Similarly, the rule says that if there are state laws that give parents latitude to say they don't want their children either vaccinated or given newborn hearing screenings, that it's essential that those parents' rights be allowed to follow the laws in their state. So as you can see, there's a wide range of kinds of services and kinds of people who are given this authority to step in and say, no, our religious or moral beliefs aren't consistent with this kind of care or this kind of coverage.
I understand that there have been religious objections to vaccinations before. I haven't heard of religious liberty concerns about hearing tests or suicide prevention. That argument is new to me. Is that something that's been out there?
You know, I think it's been out there. It's actually not something that I have written about either. You know, these things arise because interest groups that are, you know, aligned with the Trump administration's belief think there's a problem out in the country. But these are not ones that have generated a lot of attention, at least in Washington, to my knowledge.
Talking to Amy Goldstein, healthcare policy writer at The Washington Post, looking at this new set of rules from the Trump administration on when insurers or healthcare providers, or as we heard in some cases, parents, can reject or refuse to provide certain kinds of care that don't meet their religious standards. Now, we see soon after the president's remarks on the National Day of Prayer, the city of San Francisco sued the administration over these rules. What is their argument there?
Well, that's right. And let me set a little bit of this of the context around the city of San Francisco stepping in legally. So this new rule is part of a series of steps that the Trump administration has taken to try to, you know, in the lexicon of people on the ideological right, would call preserving religious freedom. People on the left would say it's discrimination, but that's the lexicon on the right. A year ago, the Department of Health and Human Services created within its longstanding Office of Civil Rights a new division on what it calls conscience and religious freedom. So there have been, as I said, a series of things that the administration is doing through executive powers, all leaning in this direction. I bring this up because a number of them have generated lawsuits. So, for instance, there is another rule, not within this rule, but another one that the administration issued some months ago that would allow some employers to not cover contraceptive services in the way that the Obama administration interpreted a section of the Affordable Care Act that relates to essential health services and preventive care. There were suits against that rule about contraception, and two judges have issued injunctions, one nationally and one spanning several states, saying that that rule can't go forward while this lawsuit is being fought out. So this new effort by the city of San Francisco is in the same vein. It's saying we think that this conscience rule that just was issued last week also is unconstitutional. And the city, which is in a pretty liberal state where there are some judges who they were appointed by Democratic presidents, they're hoping that in a similar way, this rule might be stopped as well. But time will tell.
And there's a consequence here, right? If an employer like a city like San Francisco or a hospital or whatever doesn't follow these guidelines, if, in fact, say they would fire a practitioner for refusing to provide services because of religious liberties, they could face loss of federal funds. Is that right?
Well, that's right. These rules apply to any entity, which is kind of a, you know, kind of a nerdy word, but any healthcare institution, which could be a hospital, a nursing home, a clinic, any provider of care, which could be a physician, a nurse, a tech who may be prepping patients for surgery, any of those institutions or people that in any way receive federal funding for their work. That's who's covered by this so-called conscience rule.
We're talking about President Trump's new rule on faith-based protections for healthcare workers. It would allow providers, insurers, and employers to opt out of certain services they say go against their religious or moral beliefs. It also allows parents to refuse certain kinds of healthcare services for their children, as we've been hearing. Amy Goldstein is our guest, healthcare policy writer for The Washington Post and author of the book Janesville, An American Story. You can weigh in at 800-642-1234. Are you glad that the Trump administration implemented this version of what's been called the conscience clause in the past? Or is this going to prevent patients from getting medical help they need? If you work in the medical field yourself, are there services you don't feel comfortable performing because of your religious convictions? Or do you feel that you and your colleagues should provide whatever legal services are needed by patients? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're talking to Amy Goldstein about the Trump administration's new faith-based protections for healthcare providers, insurers, and workers, allowing them to refuse to provide certain services if they don't meet their moral or religious standards. Amy is a healthcare policy writer at The Washington Post. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea? What do you think of allowing those in the healthcare business to opt out of doing certain things because of their religious beliefs? What questions do you have about the scope of this new rule from the White House? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Ben is with us in La Crosse. Ben, hello.
Hello. The Declaration of Independence states that the just powers of government derive from the will of the people. They do not derive from God. If a policeman decides that he has a religious objection to perhaps arresting a husband who beats up his wife because of his religious beliefs, the principle of these new rules would suggest that he couldn't be punished or receive any sort of reprimand for that kind of behavior. We already have the moral right and the moral opportunity to not follow the law if we feel that it's not, we feel it's morally objectionable. We just have to face the consequences of not following the law.
Ben, thanks a lot for the call. I want to, that reminds me, Ben's call reminds me, Amy, of the scope of this law. It specifies a lot of practices, just to follow his police example there. A doctor couldn't just say, I don't approve of this person's lifestyle. I'm not going to do heart surgery on them, right? It is a specific group of procedures. Do I have that correct?
That's correct. It enumerates what kinds of services somebody could say, I'm not comfortable performing. It's not the nature of somebody's way of living. You're correct about that.
And have people challenged this along the lines of what Ben is saying? I mean, he's kind of going into a separation of church and state there in some ways.
Well, I mean, this has just happened last Thursday. And this, I should say that this rule is scheduled to take effect in about 60 days. So it's just playing out in real time. On the other hand, the administration proposed this some months ago. Thursday of this past week was when it became a final rule. And yes, certainly there were church-state kinds of objections that have been raised to it.
Thanks for the call, Ben. We'll go now to Jordan in Stevens Point. Jordan, hi.
Hello there.
What did you want to bring up, Jordan?
So my question concerns if a healthcare practitioner refuses to provide care based on their religious liberties, and the person who was seeking care dies as a direct result of that lack of care, who is liable?
Jordan, thanks for the call. Is this an issue that's come up, Amy?
Well, it's an issue that hasn't come up because it hasn't been in effect yet. Mm-hmm. But that's certainly, you know, a very intriguing question. And, you know, I should say, you know, we're hearing from a couple of people who have qualms about this rule. You know, people on the other side of the debate says, look, religious freedom is, which has become kind of the lexicon of social conservatives, something they're very interested in perpetuating, that religious freedom is something that has been sort of under-recognized in this country, and the Trump administration is saying, we want to foster it. So those are the two, you know, two hands clapping in this kind of morally complex argument.
Thanks for that call. I wanted to ask about reaction in Congress and specifically House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. She has described the new rule as, quoting, downright deadly. And she says the House Democrats will fight back against this. What, assuming the House could get the Senate to agree, but what kind of options would Congress have?
Well, to the extent that, I mean, first of all, she's articulated that, but the House has not begun to do much at this point. But, you know, time will tell how this will play out. You know, hypothetically, and this is purely hypothetical, to the extent that this rule says that it's trying to enforce laws that are in place, Congress could come along and say, no, we're changing the law, so that healthcare practitioners cannot refrain to provide certain kinds of care based on their personal, religious, or moral outlook. Time will tell.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Amy Goldstein from The Washington Post about new White House rules. President Trump was talking about this last week. They take effect in a couple months. They allow healthcare providers and insurers, among others, to refuse to provide a set list of services if they have religious objections. Back to your calls now. Bree is with us in Wausau. Bree, hello.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. My question would be in regards to parents having the right to choose certain care for their children according to their religious beliefs. I'm from a town where we got rocked with the news that a family chose to pray over their, I believe, 12-year-old daughter rather than give her insulin because that was their religious belief. And the mother and the father wound up serving jail time for this because as a result, the daughter died. So where do we get to draw the line with refusing care of a child because of religious belief? And I guess I'll just take my call on here. Thank you.
Bree, thanks a lot for that call. Amy, this particular set of rules does draw a line. We were talking about that a little earlier. You mentioned a few particular examples. Are there other cases where parents could refuse particular kinds of care for their children under these rules?
Well, I'm a very bad prophet. So I'll just tell you that once this rule takes effect, if it does take effect, if it's not stopped by the courts, then I suspect that individual families will test the bounds of it. But that hasn't happened yet because it's not in effect.
Right. I mean, in every case, it sounds like this set of rules enumerate specific examples. But it sounds like you're saying people might say, well, it doesn't specifically not list these, so we might try them again. This is all hypothetical. This might see test cases outside of the specific examples given in these rules?
Perhaps. You should hear that as a big maybe.
Right, exactly. Thanks a lot for the call. Bree, we'll go now to Jerry in Galena, Illinois. Jerry, hi.
Hi, Amy. Listen, 2 points. People who attend public institutions, community college, university, MD programs, who receive from the citizens of that state, say Illinois, who receive tuition support through the citizens of a state, must provide services to the citizens of that state. They are bound by the fact that they've accepted tuition support from the citizens of that state. One. Two, patients should have the right to walk into a provider's office and see a public proclamation. That individual will not service certain folks, will not provide services to certain people.
Jerry, thanks for the call. To that second point, Amy, I don't think these rules include any requirement that a provider specifically say, hey, because of religious reasons, I'm not going to provide these services.
No, the rule doesn't do that. But, Jerry, your point is in line with what some of the strong opponents of this rule have been saying in the past few days, that people should have a right if they walk into a physician's office or any other kind of healthcare practitioner's office to know what that person will and won't do for them up front. That's become kind of a mantra of the opposition that you're reflecting. So you're not the only one, as you may know, with that point of view.
Thanks a lot for the call. Jerry, we'll go now to Stella in Sturgeon Bay. Stella, hi.
Hi. I just would like to point out that all of the discussion seems to be from the perspective of the medical provider seeing their quote religious freedom unquote being imposed upon if they are required by law to provide certain services that they have religious objections to. I would like to point out that there's another side to this story here, which is the patient coming for medical treatment and medical care is having the providers, medical providers' religious beliefs imposed, forced upon them when they may or may not, and let's take the case of may not, subscribe to those religious beliefs.
Stella, thanks for the call. We're just about out of time, but Amy, is that an argument we've heard from critics of this rule?
Well, let me just say that, we've been hearing via your callers from some people who make, quite articulate arguments out of concern for what the rule's implications may be. I suspect that there are people elsewhere in the country, people who have very different points of view, who would be arguing just as forcefully for the other side, which is what makes this all quite intriguing.
Thanks for the call. Amy, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be with you.
Amy Goldstein is a healthcare policy writer for The Washington Post. We talked with her about the Trump administration's new rules along the lines of the old Conscience Clause rules. It allows health providers, insurers, and employers to refuse to provide or pay for services they say violate their religious or moral beliefs. The city of San Francisco is suing the administration, claiming the rule would restrict access to contraception, abortion, and other medical services. Coming up after the news, we'll learn about a new collection of noir fiction set in Milwaukee. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Clean water, chronic wasting disease, and drinking water are just some of the issues the state DNR is grappling with these days. We'll talk with Secretary Designee Preston Cole coming up. First, when you think about the setting of a classic noir story, cities like New York or Los Angeles might come to mind. But in a new collection of short fiction, Milwaukee takes center stage. It brings together 14 authors with ties to Milwaukee, and their stories touch on issues like race, policing, industrial decay, and even Summerfest. Tim Hennessy is a writer and bookseller who lives in Milwaukee. He's the editor of Milwaukee Noir, which comes out tomorrow. There's an opening event tomorrow, a launch event at Boswell Books at 7 o'clock. Tim will also be in Madison on Wednesday night at the Mystery to Me bookshop. Tim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
Well, this is the latest in a series of noir collections based in different cities around the world, everywhere from Phoenix to Dublin. Why do you think Milwaukee is a good fit for this noir treatment?
Well, Milwaukee is, we're an area that was an industrial center, and it was upended by globalization. We have a rich background and history of having immigration, this being a hub for it, and the economic instability that happened once a lot of jobs were lost in the area really changed the city and changed families. And so a lot of the ideals that we had, a lot of the concepts of family and job stability really changed. And instead of having wealth, a lot of trauma was really passed from generation to generation. So it really ends up becoming all those different elements really end up helping a really great fodder for drama, unfortunately not great for a city.
And when I think of good noir in books or movies or TV shows, it's usually a combination of, looking at the bad stuff and the dark side and off the, not just the tourist destinations, but it also comes from a place of love for a city and hope for it, despite the bad stuff, that there's still something good there. Is that something you see coming through the stories in Milwaukee Noir?
Absolutely. Everybody that I look to have contribute has a background, either living in the city currently or having worked or lived in the city at one point. And so they've all gotten a chance to experience what it's like to be here on a daily basis. And I think anyone who lives in Milwaukee kind of has that mixed feeling. There's a lot of really wonderful qualities about Milwaukee, but we also have a lot of struggles that we've continued to fail to address and have made some progress on, but it's never quite what we'd all hope for. And really, that's kind of a noir sentiment, if anything, or really the kind of a resilience that I think Milwaukee has always prided itself on has always been a great current in crime fiction.
And the idea of noir literature or movies might bring to mind the tough-talking detective or the femme fatale. That's not what this is about, though. How does noir play out in this? And I know it's different from story to story, but how does it play out in the 14 stories here?
The stories all basically have more of a character based on the street point of view. We don't have any procedurals. We don't have really any perspectives from authority figures so much. One story does. But it's all people who really are a part of the community and how they experience life and the struggles and the conflicts that happen on a daily basis. Those are all parts of the stories, and the different communities are reflected in them.
Talking to Tim Hennessy, writer and bookseller and editor of the new book, Milwaukee Noir. It actually comes out tomorrow. Tim, in a way, this must have been pretty fun for you, trying to round up this crew of people with Milwaukee ties, some household names, some up-and-coming writers or people from other backgrounds. Talk about your role in getting this together.
Oh, sure. It was thrilling. I work as a bookseller, and I've worked as a book reviewer for a number of years, and I've been a reader since I was a kid. So getting to actually put together a book has always been a dream of mine, and to actually do it, especially with Akashic, is just something I never imagined was possible. I've been a big fan of this series since it started, and I had never imagined that I would be somebody who would be actually editing one. But working in a bookstore really lent itself well to finding people, because a lot of times I would be shelving or talking with customers or talking with my coworkers, and they'd have a suggestion about somebody they loved or somebody they might know. And also with some of the journalism I've done, I've gotten to meet a number of people in the mystery community in the area. So that really gave me a lot of different angles to look at how to present the city.
Name a few names. Talk about some of the authors you got to work with on this.
Sure. Jane Hamilton, isn't it? She's somebody certainly that we don't think of when we think of crime fiction. But she was somebody who was really eager to try her hand at something cool, completely outside of her norm. Nick Petrie, Valerie Lakin. Reedfail Coleman is somebody who lived here very briefly and has a real fondness for Milwaukee and was really excited to get a chance to not just write this story about Summerfest, but also to tell me about his time here, because from the time I've known him, he'd always kind of teased about what it was like when he was here. Which we also have Derek Harrell, Christy Clancy, and James Causey, and Larry Watson, and Nick Petrie.
And the book starts off with a map of neighborhoods of Milwaukee, and then I think each of the stories takes place in a different neighborhood.
Yeah, that's the key to each of the Akashic series, is they not just want to get a chance to highlight a city, but they really want to focus on neighborhoods and what makes each neighborhood distinct and adds flavor to a city. And that's something Milwaukee has an abundance of, as many large cities do.
Now, race and segregation, of course, are issues that Milwaukee grapples with in some ways more than most cities. It plays a role in some of the stories in the book. How do the authors in the book tackle issues of race and segregation?
They presented a real apathetic side, or not apathetic, or a very empathetic approach to the stories. All of them really looked at not just how it was affecting the main characters, but also kind of the neighborhoods. And it really showed how it's a conflict that has grown and has multifacets, and there are more. And I wanted, especially since race is such a struggle for the city to progress beyond, I wanted to make sure if we had the potential to possibly look at it from multiple angles.
And you talk about in your introduction of the book that you love Milwaukee's lack of pretension. Could you talk about how that shows up in these stories?
Yeah, Milwaukee is always – the thing I've always loved about it is if you tell them that you want to write, people here kind of look at you like, so what? I like – you know, I have hobbies too. And that's kind of a wonderful quality and to be a writer with, because you really don't approach it with, you know, any preciousness. And the stories themselves, they have that perspective too. They have a lot of the characters, their ambitions are often to get from day to day and sometimes just to resolve the conflicts within their daily lives more than maybe grander things. And Milwaukee has that lack of pretension.
And you also write that there's a fact about Milwaukee that's often overlooked by people not from the area, maybe even people from Milwaukee. It has a strong creative tradition.
It does. There are a number of people who both live here as well as who've moved away. And even people who – Milwaukee is always a place nationally as well as worldwide that people really hold a fondness for. And it's that quality that I really wanted to tap into and find people who live in the area as well as were outside of it, who could write to what that feeling was like so that people outside could get a sense of what makes Milwaukee a special place.
Now, the stories you've collected, the authors you've collected, give us a tour of Milwaukee, sometimes not the most pleasant face of the city, but hopefully an honest face of it. What do you hope that a reader takes away from it after the book opens and they get their hands on it and go through the stories?
I really hope that people who read it get a sense of what the community is like and what the city is like, as well as get a chance to see what kind of talents we have here. We're usually not the people to toot our own horns, and getting a chance to really put together the first collection of fiction that solely is based around Milwaukee authors was thrilling to me. As a kid, that was something I really wanted to have. I always grew up looking to see representation of Milwaukee. So for me to be able to do something like that, and hopefully there are other people who, whether their neighborhoods or their experiences are represented, maybe that will be the creative challenge for them to go forward and think of themselves and their experience in a new way to hopefully lend themselves to their works.
In our last few minutes, or moments, I should say, Tim, do you have the taste for this now? Do you want to do another collection, maybe on another theme, but set orbiting around Milwaukee?
Absolutely. I mean, my own work, I definitely have always leaned more towards looking at locations, especially in Wisconsin and Milwaukee specifically, because it's really not something that people know about. And when it's a location that you don't know much about, it's always a little more exotic. But I would certainly love to do more projects like this.
Tim, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us in our Milwaukee studio.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
That's Tim Hennessy, editor of the short story collection Milwaukee Noir. He'll be joining some of the authors from the book at a launch event that's tomorrow in Milwaukee. It's 7 o'clock at night at Boswell Books. He'll be in Madison on Wednesday night for a release at the Mystery to Me bookshop. Coming up, we'll talk with the head of the State Department of Natural Resources, just appointed by Governor Tony Evers, not yet approved by the legislature. We'll talk about the agency's proposed budget and other priorities, including clean drinking water around Wisconsin. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, several thousand plane passengers were rerouted to a small Canadian town following the terrorist attacks on September 11th. A new musical chronicling the plight of the passengers and the people of Gander, Newfoundland, and how they came together and formed friendships is coming to Milwaukee. We'll learn more about that and meet a Milwaukee woman who was there. First, the head of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources says there are two big priorities for the agency. At the top, clean water. A close second, chronic wasting disease in the state's deer herds. Governor Evers has declared 2019 the year of clean drinking water. His budget proposals include the removal of pipes that seep lead into drinking water and ending pollution of rural water supplies. Preston Cole is the secretary appointee of the state DNR. Secretary Designee Cole, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, why is water quality your number one issue this year?
Well, as the governor has already indicated several times with his mandate of the year of clean drinking water, it's a human health issue. You got to believe and you got to know that there are places in the state of Wisconsin where they don't have surety as to what's coming out of the end of the tap, whether it's in Kewaunee County in that area, southwest Wisconsin and Iowa County, Grant, in Lafayette with nitrates in drinking water from the wells, or lead laterals in our some of our oldest cities, from Superior to Milwaukee to Beloit. You've got 130 towns and villages and cities in Wisconsin that all have lead laterals, and people like to talk about Milwaukee, but there are a number of locations around the state of Wisconsin that needs to have those lead laterals replaced.
And the governor has proposed about, I think, $40 million for lead pipe replacement around the state. How far is that going to get us?
Well, it's a sum total to, take that amount of lead laterals out. It's probably estimated at a $2 billion lift. We don't have $2 billion, so we have to get at it incrementally around the state of Wisconsin.
Some lawmakers from rural areas have said, hey, most of this money we think is going to go to Milwaukee. It's a good cause, but we're not comfortable sending money from around the state that's going to be so devoted to Milwaukee. What do you say about that concern?
Well, Milwaukee is certainly the largest city and has the largest amount of lead laterals at about 77,000. And again, Milwaukee is one of 130 cities, towns, and villages. While Milwaukee has a, dire need for replacements of lead laterals, it's just a sheer number of percentage of lead laterals that causes Milwaukee to receive that type of enumeration. You would tend to think that, an equalized value, equalized number of properties, when you're looking at 77,000 versus there's some that have 10, 11, 12 lead laterals, it's just the magnitude of the issue.
Now, you mentioned some of the specific rural concerns we have in northeastern Wisconsin and now southwestern Wisconsin. What kind of things in the budget and at the DNR are you targeting when it comes to these drinking water concerns that aren't concerned with lead pipes?
Well, I'm happy to report that, organizations like the Farm Bureau and the farming community are coming to the table to begin the discussions as to what goes on land and what ultimately comes off of lands and winds up in our drinking water. And so we've asked for five more scientists associated with, groundwater and how we can reduce the amount of chemicals from the land that get into our drinking water and our wells, those in terms of emerging contaminants like PFAS, and of course, manure spreading and those practices. And again, I'm happy to report that we're getting positive feedback from the farming communities and the organizations that represent them as to we're ready to come to the table and let's work this out.
So studying and negotiation, there are people, as you mentioned, who right now can't drink what's coming out of their taps. Is there something you can tell them that says, hey, this year something's going to get better?
Well, what I will report is that we've put in approximately $83 million worth of funding for a variety from drinking water, contaminated wells, cleaning up some of our shores from Milwaukee to Lake Superior from contaminated sediment. And again, those individuals who have wells, they often need to be repaired, and many of them don't work like they should. So consequently, that $83 million represents a variety of approaches to solving a myriad of drinking water issues in all parts of the state.
Now, this budget is a big document. There's going to be a lot of battles between the governor and Republican lawmakers. Do you see places when it comes to water quality where you think you're mostly on the same page?
Well, when you see Speaker Voss putting together his task force on drinking water, and that'll be chaired by Representative Novak, and when they go around the state and host somewhere between 10 to 12 listening sessions, it begins to tell you that their fact-finding, what they're going to find out is information that's certainly been on the landscape. It's different in Portage. It's different in Superior. It's different in Milwaukee. And so you would tend to believe that you only have that type of task force if you're going to try to reconcile laws and that could approach this and funding levels that could approach this. So if we're going to get something done, I think it's up to the speaker and the governor. And again, it's a positive sign that the legislature is going on the road and listening to other communities about drinking water.
Talking to Preston Cole, he's the secretary appointee of Wisconsin's Department of Natural Resources. Let's move on from drinking water for now and look at chronic wasting disease, this long-running and growing problem in the state. there's some concerns from people in the conservation community and Republicans that there's not enough in this budget to amp up the state's response. So what do you see happening here?
Well, again, the governor left in place approximately $2.6 million, which was proposed by the previous administration relative to chronic wasting disease. Much of that money is for testing, about $990,000 for testing. I've been tasked with reconciling those concerns of individuals from the conservation organizations to individuals certainly in deer farms as well. That said, we have to report back as to what has the state of Wisconsin acquired after spending $52 million on chronic wasting disease to date. And what does that go-forward strategy look like? So in order for us to go forward, I have staff collecting data from the Great Lakes regions to see what other states are doing. We know that we would love to fund a quick test. And a quick test is important for CWD so that a hunter can know in short order, you know, in 24 or 48 hours. Right now, it's about 12 to 15 days. That's driving people away from the sport. And, of course, that's the level of concern as this disease moves. So for $52 million, the disease has moved and continues to move. But we get positive insights from other states. State of Michigan sent $5 million to Michigan State University to come up with that quick test. And so what does Wisconsinites get from that? Well, when that quick test has been done, we're going to get that quick test. And quite frankly, the state of Wisconsin doesn't have to spend another $5 million to do that type of research. So the regulators and the DNRs around the Great Lakes, we're in conversation with those individuals, and we'll be able to report back what our strategies are, where the research gaps are from a gap analysis that we'll wind up providing. And then we want to give surety that, you know, this disease still may move and continue to move as long as we have practices like, you know, baiting and feeding and carcass movements in places where deer carcasses shouldn't be moved.
I want to turn to Wisconsin State Park funding under the Walker administration. There's a pretty big change in state support, taking away a lot of state support, making the state parks, in effect, self-sustaining. What are you looking at in this year's budget?
Well, again, there's a additional resources, $1.3 million, that has been enumerated in the budget. Of course, it's being run like a business operation, and what comes in gets, goes into what I would call the infrastructure improvements. But there's just not enough money to fix all of the what I call legacy building repairs and modifications that have to be done. So we lean heavily on the state's building commission to assist in providing capital funding for some of those properties. And until such a time, again, we'll have to do the paint and fix ups ourselves.
I want to wrap up just talking about your philosophy of the role of Wisconsin's Department of Natural Resources. People have taken different approaches to your job over the years and over the administrations. How do you view the role of the DNR?
Well, I represent approximately, 2,400 or so hardworking Department of Natural Resource employees, and they're our greatest assets. And the role that we play, and you should also know this is, State Employees Week. So if folks are looking for a job, go to WisJobs, look up the DNR, come work for us. Consequently, we're here environmental protection. We're in resource management. And so those 2,400 employees in every given day are finding ways to relieve us from contaminants in our soils and waters, to make sure that the fish population is thriving, to understand the forest and the process of, managing timber in a state like Wisconsin, to our wildlife and those individuals that work on making sure that we have abundant wildlife and recreational opportunities from our parks and recreational areas. So, our philosophy is service. And so we provide service to those individuals who want to do business with us. We lean heavily on service excellence. And each and every day we wake up, put our boots on, and go work for what I call the greatest department in state government.
Secretary Designee Cole, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. And quite frankly, this is the best job I ever have. I love it. It's difficult at times and challenging, but that makes it worthwhile.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Preston Cole is the secretary designee of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. He joined us to look at the DNR budget this year. We're in the midst of the budget process and other issues facing the agency, including clean water and chronic wasting disease in Wisconsin deer. There's big news in the game show world lately. Jeopardy contestant James Holzhauer has racked up a 20-some-day winning streak, winning lots of money along the way, and raising questions about whether or not he can beat Ken Jennings' winning record. And closer to home, Gail Rice of Wisconsin Rapids won an episode of The Price is Right on a trip to the taping for her 70th birthday. Our own Dean Kinetter has been a step away from game show greatness himself. Hey, Dean.
Hey, Rob.
Now, you once, I didn't know this, I found out this out today, you once went to the Price is Right set in Los Angeles for a taping of the show.
I did. It was the day after the Wisconsin Badgers lost the 2012 Rose Bowl. We figured what better way to cheer up than to go to the Price is Right. And I did not get my name called. However, my friend sitting right next to me did.
And I want to ask about your response. Now, everyone, I think, who's ever lived in humankind knows that if you are called or next to the person called on The Price is Right, you have to completely freak out, right? That is your civic duty.
Oh, I did that, too. It was unplanned. It was genuine, the
oh,
reaction.
Really?
And I look like a complete fool, but it is out there somewhere in the CBS archives, me jumping up and down and hugging my friend as he runs down and gets all the high fives.
Now, did you guys did you audition or something? Did you talk to producers and they're like looking for the one who's going to really sell it?
You do go through a line, and the producer, I think, gives you a bit of a personality test, which I clearly failed.
Sorry, man.
That's
and you also once met the current record holder on Jeopardy, Ken Jennings.
Ken, yeah. I met him at a book signing in
Nyquan. First name basis.
Really nice guy, but his records are in Jeopardy.
Uh-oh. Very nice. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.